Until this plague, it was little appreciated how technology, scientific research and development included, speeds up both success and disaster. Samuel B. Valcourt. Hals Anders Bergen, not feeling at all like the influential Secretary General of the United Nations, slammed the door of his office and strode across to stop, then leaned with both fists on his desk. "This can't go on," he thought. It was almost dark outside, the end of a foggy spring day in a New York City oddly similar to what it had been for more than 50 years. People hurrying to get off the streets before nightfall. Busy streets at this hour had been a mark of the city for as long as Bergen could recall. He could hear the traffic sounds even at this height. New York had always been a noisy city at nightfall, he thought. Activity still buzzed, too, in the halls and offices outside Bergen's doors. The UN was a ferment of reports and rumors. The Chinese at Changsha were not denying that they stood on the edge of an important medical announcement. A brilliant new research team in Brazilian Israel had just that morning made cautious revelation of a cryogenic suspension technique that preserved the life of an infected female indefinitely. The Swiss were reporting mixed success with a dangerous chemotherapeutic approach to the plague. Trust the Israelis and the Swiss to produce brilliantly unorthodox techniques to meet this problem, Bergen thought. They were alike in this, closing ranks and turning inward for their superb strength. And what was happening at Huddersfield? Bergen straightened and flexed the sore muscles of his hands. Bad habit, that, making fists when he was upset. On top of what had happened this morning in Philadelphia, the British action, shutting down all but the most essential communications with the outside, filled Bergen with disquiet. He moved around his desk and seated himself in his fine Danish chair. The traffic sounds were particularly clear in this position. The differences from BP New York had been mostly accepted, he was told. Checkpoints every few blocks, identification scanners, apartment wardens who were supposed to know every occupant by sight. How quickly the outrageous became routine. Very little partying these days, Bergen knew. More's the pity. A good, relaxing, old-fashioned party was exactly what he needed right now. Take his mind off the problems before him, especially this new one demanding that he make a decision. Too many unknowns lurked just at the edges of awareness, Bergen thought. Why had Ruckerman been sent to England? Bergen did not buy for a moment the story that an advisor to the President of the United States had been accidentally contaminated. Valcourt was up to something. A canny fellow, Valcourt. Look how quickly he had appeared to jump on the Pope's bandwagon, speaking out against unbridled science. Of course, that stand would be reassessed in view of what had just happened in Philadelphia. Explosion of a gas main followed by an uncontrolled fire, and the Pope and 9 cardinals were dead. Accident? Bergen thought not. It had the smell of a contrived incident. Too many people were on the street side rumor mill saying it was God's judgment for the Pope's attack on scientists. This had been planned and executed by a master assassin with almost unlimited resources. Valcourt's doing? Well, the streets were a dangerous place to play that game, as the Soviets had learned to their dismay. Get people used to mobbing up, and the many-footed animal could turn against you. Get people accustomed to spreading rumors, and the rumor system took on a life of its own. False reports and quack cures were rampant in the streets all over the world, Bergen knew. It required special teams to chase them down and quiet them, or, God help them, find that one had been confirmed. Vinegar baths, for the love of heaven! There was no doubt at all that the plague was mutating and spreading into animal populations, both feral and tame. Valcourt had said privately that he already was taking actions to preserve certain key species, cattle, pigs, dogs, house cats. Other nations surely were taking similar steps, or would be soon. The UN's private alert system had spread the word quietly, but it surely would be public knowledge within hours. What can we do? Will we have to write off all wild species? Africa was a lost cause. No hope there at all. Some Indian elephants might survive, especially in places like the Berlin Zoological Gardens, which remained intact thanks to the Soviet Union's Iron Ring buffer zone. The Iron Ring was being hailed as a superb, self-sacrificing Soviet intervention. Bergen shook his head. Only a few years back, the Iron Curtain had been generally cursed. Now, the Iron Ring was a boon to mankind. Bergen leaned his head into his open palms. How scattered his thoughts were! Any diversion at all was welcomed to put off the moment when he had to make his decision. The question was not, should they try to save the world's feral populations? It was, how do we break the news that such an effort is impossible? The animals of the sea would not survive. Fini the whale, fini the gentle porpoise, fini the amusing sea lion, fini the happy sea otter, fini, fini, fini. Wolf, coyote, badger, prairie dog, culon, panda, civet cat, hedgehog, antelope, deer. Good God, he thought, the deer. Bergen had visions of hunters, already bridling at confinement away from their annual forest orgy, reacting to announcement that the deer was fini, and the elk, the bison. No more Groundhog Day. The concept endangered species had become ridiculous. How could he concern himself with tigers, jaguars, leopards, and sea cows when man was now among the world's most endangered species? If only people could be united to... Bergen straightened, holding to this thought, sensing something valuable in it. A volunteer project? Contributions? People would laugh at a financial effort to save wild animals, collecting for such creatures while humans remained in peril. There would be outcry against bleeding hearts. But the wild animals were valuable. To science, to genetics especially, to research. Scientists might be reduced to using only humans as guinea pigs. That carried very nasty overtones in its effects on morality. Morality, yes. Bergen thought about the report he had been handed only a half hour ago, the thing that had angered him so deeply. He had known for some weeks that elements close to the centers of power in the U.S. Capitol were fomenting unrest among American Muslims. Rumors of a secret base in the Sudan were rampant. There were stories that Muslims from the Sudan were prepared to launch an infective jihad, breaking out of their confinement to kill infidels with sword and knife, and to kill the women merely by breathing upon them. What had happened to the old human values? Bergen felt that he fought a lonely battle to preserve something of the old human values. Concern for your neighbor. The golden rule. The report he had been handed before storming into his office had identified the source of the local Muslim unrest. Shiloh Broderick. Bergen had come to look upon Broderick as a satanic figure, the essence of all that must be suppressed, that the world might be restored to some semblance of its former order. Broderick's agents were at work in New York City and in five other key centers, including Philadelphia. The report made this undeniable. Had it been Broderick behind the death of the Pope? Bergen was prepared to believe it. How to save the best of human morality in the face of such men? Bergen could feel the new surge in plague research. They were on the verge of momentous things. Announcement could come momentarily. The good things from the past had to be preserved. Save the animals. He began to see the shape of it then. A rallying cry. A diversion to occupy embattled people and get them past this last bad time until the researchers provided a plague cure. The idea gave Bergen something restorative and opened up an answer to his other problem. Should the report on Broderick be shared with Velcourt? Bergen was not free of the suspicion that the president might somehow be involved with Shiloh Broderick. They said the two hated each other, but that was an old ploy. Broderick might be a very handy tool to people such as Velcourt. No matter. Knowledge that the Secretary General of the United Nations knew about Broderick's latest incursion might put a damper on further violence from that source. And Bergen knew he had an upbeat note on which to end the exchange. Save the animals. Bergen reached for the red telephone in his desk drawer, and had actually touched the phone when a change in the noises outside his office caused him to hesitate. Something crashed out there. He could hear a difference in the human sounds. Shouts, distressed cries, some of them cut off abruptly. He removed his hand from the red telephone and stood up, was standing there undecided when his door burst open. A man in a dark ski mask and carrying a silenced machine gun stood there. The burst of bullets that cut across Bergen's chest stitched a pattern of holes in the window behind him. The gunman uttered a wild cry, the last sound that Bergen's ears reported. Inshallah! O king that was born to set bondsmen free, in the coming battle, help the Gael. Old Irish prayer. It was three horsemen racing along the loch from the south, black movement in the fading light. John saw them at a distance, hearing at the same time the movement of many heavy vehicles on the hills above the facility. The horses were lathered, he saw, but still responding to the crop. John watched them from a position on the lawn fronting the loch where he had gone to be alone after a harried day. He knew he was not really alone. There were men watching from a doorway behind him. He did not have enough emotion left even to resent this. He felt drained, incapable of any strong movement. Questions, questions, questions. There had been hardly a moment this day when someone was not picking at him, and the answers poured from his mouth without conscious volition. Another voice, another personality, which acted from within, rising out of an alarming source of independence. Was it O'Neill within? He could not even be sure of that. The horsemen were still at some distance, but not slackening their pace. John noted that the riders did not look back, which he interpreted as meaning they were not someone's quarry. The urgency of their movement struck him then. Something about them. He felt the coldness of impending disaster. The sound of approaching vehicles had grown louder, but he could hear the beat of the horses' hooves now. His chest felt tight. Then he recognized two of the riders. Oh, God! It was Kevin O'Donnell and Joseph Harity beside him, a stranger close behind. The horses plunged onward against a backdrop of stone-pocked hills, a landscape that darkened by the second as the sun dipped toward the western hills. Why were Kevin O'Donnell and Joseph Harity coming here, and on horseback? He watched the men gallop past him up the lawn. Harity gave John a devil's grin as he passed, but the others did not even turn. They drew up at the courtyard formed by the two lakeside wings of the building, dropped their reins and strode inside past John's watchers without a word. Arrival on horseback. Why should that be threatening? John wondered. As the sun dropped behind the hills, leaving his world in the long twilight, it grew colder. John shivered. He had been 9 weeks here, seeing the slow shift from senseless industry to a new vitality. They had the best equipment in the world, all of it sent in on the free boats via the Finn Sadle, and it was beginning to focus correctly at last. John had felt the excitement all day, another reason he was drained. They had kept him in the south wing most of the day, introducing lab technicians to advanced computer techniques, showing them how to bring automation into their efforts. Another week, two at the most, and they would have the plague pathogen in their hands. After that... What? Once during this day, John had thought he glimpsed Doheny at a distance across the grounds. There had been a great deal of activity over there at the old castle structure, the central core of this complex. A big flatbed truck had backed into a newly made hole in a brick wall there. It had emerged after a time with a large black tubular thing lashed to its bed. It had looked to John like a big steel tank. The truck had been joined by armored cars and a whole convoy, which had taken the turn for the road to the northeast. He had been told earlier that Kells was in that direction, and Dundalk on the Irish Sea, places he knew he probably would never see. Old Moon came in then and asked John to come along to the culture lab and check the setup for its automation changes. Moon was a fixture around the lab, John realized. The old man shuffled along in his decrepit way, purposeful but lacking a necessary elan. Many of the researchers here had shown that same lack of vital independence until John's revelations had fired them. Perhaps Moon did not know what was happening at the tiled benches and esoteric equipment he passed by so often. The man betrayed no awe of the scientist. If anything, he seemed disdainful toward all around him. It was an old pattern, John thought. Scientists earned this response. He recalled the few famous scientists he had met, realizing how different they had seemed from ordinary mortals. The minds of scientists differed from the minds of other humans, John thought. The scientist rode at a higher elevation. He saw farther across the landscape. People expected from such men the behavior of the cavalier, of the romantic leader. John looked out across the loch where everything had gone to gray. I was a scientist, he thought. It was a strange thought, foreign, forcing him to reassess these differences he had sensed. Those differences were far more telling than the old romances would have it, he realized. He had worked with a narrowed vision. That was it. Even the near reaches were denied him. It was a gaze that could sweep past the individual without a change of focus. Abstract dedication to the project. Not even hope was allowed. Only the immediate result. John began to see a new sense in the things Doheny had said back at Kilmainham. No more myths? The people here had been wandering through their own despairs until John's arrival. They had gone through the paces out of habit. Training had given them patterns they could follow, but the patterns would not deviate from known tracks. Can they really use what I've given them? John asked himself. It was a desperate thought rising from that lost place within him. He could reconstruct the plague. He knew that. But the cure? He turned back toward the buildings and, picking up his watchdogs, made his way up to his room. Supper sat heavy in his stomach, and he knew he would not sleep soon, but he was glad to hear them throw the bolt and seal him into this place. He left the lights off and watched the darkness settle over the lock. There was a pounding somewhere. Clump, clump! As though awakening from a dream, John realized the pounding was feet running along the hallway. His door was flung open and Doheny darted into the room, blinking at the gloom after the brightness of the hall. He turned on the overhead light, closed the door, and stared at John. "You must listen to me very carefully and do what I say," Doheny said. "We haven't much time." There was shouting outside the building and more sounds of heavy vehicles. John stared at Doheny. "It's the curse of Ireland," Doheny said. "We are doomed to repeat ourselves endlessly." "What's happening?" "Kevin O'Donnell has seized control over this region," Doheny said. "I've known for 2 days he was going to do it. Alex warned me." Doheny shook his head. "Kevin and Joseph have worked some devil's agreement between them, and they've come to see it done. But why have you come running in here like this? What's this have to do with me?" "They're interrogating the priest and the boy," Doheny said. John felt a constriction in his chest. "If they threaten the boy," Doheny said, "Father Michael will break the seal of the confessional. I know him." "What will he tell them, John?" John opened his mouth but could not speak. His voice refused to perform. "Kevin and Joseph are the same kind of man," Doheny said. "Extremists and fanatics. It's all the same. Anything's an excuse for getting high on their own adrenaline. it's a dope, and they'll do anything for a fix. They'll keep after the priest until they've emptied him and filled themselves. John closed his mouth, still unable to speak. "Who are you, John Garrick O'Donnell?" Doheny asked. "Who are you, really?" "I've told you," John gasped. The words hurt his throat. "Did you tell the priest as well?" John hunched his shoulders, leaning forward. The pain in his chest and throat demanded relief. "They've found his fingerprints and dental charts in the States," Doheny said.
"Whose?"
It was all John could speak. "O'Neill's, of course. They're playing it cagey, the bastards, but we'll have them in time." "What will those fingerprints and dental charts show us, John?" John shook his head from side to side, once more mute. He could not feel O'Neill within. He could only feel a great emptiness there.
"You're a queer specimen, and that's no mistake," Doheny said. "Do you have real feelings?"
John stared back at Doheny, locked in place by those questioning eyes.
"We're that close to victory," Doheny said.
"That close." He held up thumb and forefinger of his right hand, a tiny gap between them.
"And now this,"
John managed a whisper.
"What's happening?"
"The thing that always destroys us," Doheny said.
"Victory. We cannot take victory. It sets us against each other, a victory does. Like dogs over a bone. That's what every Irish victory becomes, a bone polished by our own teeth, and no meat left on it at all. In the end, we throw it away for the useless thing it is."
John's lips once more formed the words,
"What's happening?"
There was no voice behind it. Doheny cocked an ear toward the door. There was a faint slamming sound in the distance. He said,
"The truth is, we Irish, preferring to make epics out of disasters, could find no victory to serve the same function. We may say otherwise, but our actions give the truth to my words. We prefer disasters."
John backed away from Doheny, stopped by the side of the cot. His knees trembled.
"You're going to be put on trial, John," Doheny said.
"And they'll have me along afterwards to stand in their dock." He grinned. "Because I've denied to Kevin the real prize he sought here. Little Katie Browder." Feet could be heard running in the hallway.
"Listen to me, John," Doheny said. "You must demand Father Michael for your defense counsel."
John found a hoarse whisper with which to speak.
"Defend me from what? Promise me, you fool."
John's head nodded agreement on its own. The door behind Doheny was slammed open with such force that it crashed into the wall. John stared out at a cluster of armed men framed in the open doorway. Joseph Herity stood in the forefront, grinning at him.
"Rachel, Rachel, I've been thinking what a fine world this would be if the girls could be transported from beyond the deep blue sea."
Songs of the New Ireland. For Kate O'Gara Browder, the flight from the research facility was a nightmare from beginning to end. Doheny had given them little time to think or question his decision.
"It's for your own safety." "But where are we going?"
Stephen had asked. He had peered out at Doheny through the same small port where Father Michael Flannery had stood the previous morning to perform the marriage ceremony.
"To Dundalk for now," Doheny said.
Even as he spoke, there had been no turning back. It had begun with the stopping of the air pumps, that constant reassuring noise that told them the chamber's pressure was higher than the pressure outside, that nothing of the plague might creep into this sanctuary. They had lived with the sound so long by then that they no longer noticed it. But the absence.
"Stephen, the air pumps have stopped."
He leaped to his feet and dashed to the main porthole, which commanded a view of the enclosing area outside and some of the equipment.
"What do you see?"
she demanded, pressing close behind him. A sense of engulfing terror gripped her.
"Please, God, not now." "There's no one out there," Stephen said.
He went to the communications panel and thumbed the microphone switch.
Oi, out there! What's going on?
There was no response. They heard it then, many footsteps, the sound curiously localized by the speaker above the port. There was a dragging noise with the sound of footsteps, heavy dragging and the sound of metal scraping on stones.
There's Doheny, Stephen said.
She squeezed in beside Stephen to peer out at Doheny. He looked flushed. His fuzzy hair was more disarrayed than usual. Doheny took up the outside phone.
It's all right. The pump will not be off long, he said. But what's happening? Stephen demanded.
That was when Doheny said they were being moved for their own safety, being taken to Dundalk.
Why Dundalk? Kate wondered.
Be sure to take your supply of the antiseptic in with you, Doheny said. And that rope you used for a safety line when we moved you from the barn. Rig that again. You may be tossed about a bit.
Doheny's instructions were uttered in an intense monotone that they had never before heard from him. They were to take everything they thought they would need and stow it securely in the original chamber from Peard's barn. Stephen was to paint antiseptic around the tank's entry port. And hurry! Men with cutting torches were waiting to burn away the metal juncture between the original tank and the one built here.
We can't move both of them, Doheny explained.
But why are we doing this? Stephen persisted.
Because I've convinced some friends in the army that we cannot keep Kate alive here.
Where's Adrian? Stephen asked.
He's under guard in his quarters. Adrian's joined the enemy. Keep your pistol with you, Stephen. Kevin O'Donnell's coming and there's no stopping him. He's insane, and he wants Kate.
But why Dundalk? Kate asked.
Because we hope to get you completely out of Ireland. We've enough of the army and others loyal to us that we can get you safely to Dundalk. From there...
Doheny broke off.
Where?
Stephen demanded.
To England, we hope. Everything depends on Barrier Command.
Doheny returned to his original instructions then.
And it would not hurt to drench a sheet with the antiseptic. Put it over the inside of the access port after you've closed and sealed it.
The air pressure, Stephen said.
We'll have a pump going again soon as we put you onto the lorry. You'll have positive pressure again. Best get into the little chamber as rapidly as you can.
Nillan Gunn, commander of the Killaloe Guard, had come down then to take over from Doheny, telling the latter he was needed in communications. Gunn was a slender, dark Galway man with slightly bowed legs and a face with small features. He had been a commander in the constabulary before the plague.
"Don't worry, lass," he told Kate. "We'll not let the mad O'Donnell have you."
Moon had been right behind him
to say goodbye. "Trust Finn Doheny and Nillan here," he said. "They'll save you. And don't have any more truck with Adrian Peard."
"What has Adrian done?"
Stephen asked. He felt that the ground was being cut away from beneath him.
"Adrian betraying them? How? What had he done?"
"I've had a little microphone in the bastard's office for months now," Moon said. "He was too slick for me. Sure enough, he's unlocked the door for Kevin O'Donnell to come and lord it over us."
Stephen had heard the stories of Kevin O'Donnell and the Beach Boys. He glanced at Kate.
"Do what Nealon tells you," Moon said.
"Goodbye, Katie. Have a brave child, even if you are married."
Chuckling, he left them. It was all mad movement then, loud conversations and the sound of heavy equipment outside, the outer wall being breached. She and Stephen entered the small chamber finally, and Stephen sealed the inner port, drenched a sheet with antiseptic, and fastened it over the port. The small space reeked with the acrid smell of the antiseptic. Kate sat close to Stephen on the bed, clutching him tightly when she heard the burners cutting away the outer chamber, even tighter when the cables went around their container and it swung free to settle with a thump onto an unsteady support on the lorry. The lashing cables rang against the chamber's steel when they were dropped into place and tightened. The end port gave them a view of the new opening through the bricks that had been put there such a short time ago to enclose their containers. The sound of the compressor returned, soothing them somewhat. They could hear the generator motor chugging loudly behind them near the lorry's cab. The lorry began to move so gently that they did not feel it at first. Then they saw the opening into the castle receding and felt a wheel lurch into a rut. There was the sound of other vehicles, several of them. Stephen peered outside.
"A lot of armored cars," he said. "Must be 10 or 12 of them."
Nilan Gunn's voice came to them then from the little emergency speaker near the head of the bed.
"Everything all right in there?"
Stephen found the microphone and keyed it.
"It seems to be okay. How long will we be like this?"
"No telling, lad. But I'm up here with the driver. Sing out if you need me."
Stephen looked at Kate. She appeared pale and her forehead was deeply furrowed.
"Why don't you stretch out and try to sleep, darling?" "I couldn't sleep."
"But you'd be safer if you were on the mattress there."
"No, I wouldn't. This is not safe."
She closed her eyes. The baby felt so heavy in her abdomen, and she needed to void her bladder. There was nothing for it but the little toilet they had used at first. She made Stephen turn away while she crawled to the convenience and used it. She was hungry then, and all Stephen could provide was canned fish and beans, both cold. He insisted she take her vitamins before he would give her the food. He could be so callous, she thought, studying his medical books at all hours, never looking up even when she stared at him, needing him. He had no idea at all about her absolute longing for a crisp stalk of celery cold from the garden. Fresh green lettuce. Oh, how she longed for it. Or a raw carrot. Surely by now they should have devised a way to sterilize fresh foods for this chamber. She lay back after eating and watched Stephen crouched there by one of the ports, staring out at the passing landscape. She had no desire to look at it with him. He would only remind her that she was confined and could not go out there to walk through the fields, breathing fresh air that did not smell of a chemical toilet. What would he do if she screamed at him, she wondered. She felt like screaming. What a dumpy little prison this was. More than 6 months confined like this. And when she complained, all Stephen could do was remind her that this chamber preserved her life. Kate had heard descriptions of the plague's effect on women. Terrifying. She held to a tempting fantasy, though. There must be an island somewhere free of the plague. She and Stephen would go there and walk freely in the open once more. Perhaps that would happen even now. The most awful part of this confinement was the absence of a door out of it. She stared at the sheet covering the sealed port. But they had a door now. Something rolled against her left elbow, dislodged by the lorry's movement. She looked down and saw the little television that had been provided them at the facility. She put down an urge to break the thing. It was like the portholes. When it was not providing views of the unattainable, it showed them bad news. If it weren't so confining and boring in here. Stephen always reminded her they had plenty to read. Their keepers could sterilize books, but they couldn't sterilize fresh fruits and vegetables. That was because they could use caustic antiseptics and heavy ultraviolet on the books, as smarty Stephen would point out if she raised the issue.
Damn Stephen. He made me pregnant, and now he won't even talk to me when I need him. I want out, she whispered.
Stephen did not hear her above the sounds of the lorry, which reverberated in the chamber's confinement. Kate tried to imagine what it would be like to step out of the chamber. She would live for a little while, she knew, but it was no longer the world out there that she had known. This world was not the world of before O'Neill. The madman had changed it, because of a woman. They killed his wife. Kate knew there had been children killed too, two of them. But it was more romantic to think of this having been done for love of a woman.
Would Stephen do such a thing for me?
Madman O'Neill had completely changed their world because they killed his wife.
Changed.
She had heard the news summary from Continental BBC the previous night. In all the world, 5,000 men for every surviving woman. This had fascinated her, but Stephen had appeared worried when he looked at her. The announcer's report of the disproportionate numbers had been prelude to comment on a new phenomenon. The Lysistrata syndrome, he called it. Kate remembered his words exactly. "Women are clamoring for positions of power. Who is to deny them this? Will the church now refuse to enroll them as clergy?" Women priests, Kate thought. As the Catholic Church struggles to choose a new pope in the wake of the Philadelphia tragedy, the commentator said, it must also confront the need to recognize a change in the roles of men and women. This world is moving away from its past at a rate never before seen. The new pope, whoever that may be, will be required to make momentous decisions. Every day that we are denied a cure for the plague only makes it more apparent that we, mere mortals, have judged wrongly in the past. The commentator had cleared his throat. Then, "This is George Bailey from the Continental BBC, Paris." Stephen's only comment had been, "The haves and the have-nots. That has a new meaning now." She knew what Stephen feared would happen. Every woman with a dozen or more husbands. Chattel. Women owned by their husbands. The motion of the lorry lulled her, and Kate fell asleep after a time. Stephen glanced down at her, his expression worried. Poor Kate. It was beginning to get cold in the chamber. He found a blanket and spread it over her. She stirred restlessly under his touch, but did not awaken. She remained asleep even when Nillan Gunn spoke again from the lorry's cab.
"We've just had a signal from Barrier Command. Admiral Francis Delacourt himself. He has our request under advisement, but he says also his orders are to assist in any legitimate undertaking associated with plague research. It sounds like a pompous arse."
Kate awakened after a while, only to use the convenience and inquire if she had heard Gunn speaking, or was that a dream? "Barrier Command's been asked to provide us with passage to England," Stephen said, extracting the sense from Gunn's words. Her voice was sleepy as she returned to the bed and pulled the blanket up to her chin.
"Why would they send us to England?"
"I think there's going to be another civil war in Ireland," Stephen said. "Doheny wants us in a safe place."
"Men,"
she muttered. The lorry stopped at dusk below the crest of a hill. Stephen, looking out a port, saw 8 tanks parked beside the road. A helmeted figure stood out of the lead tank's hatch and called to the lorry.
"We've the situation in hand. Go straight down to the docks. There'll be a jeep to lead you at the next intersection."
The lorry eased ahead in low gear, topped the hill, and gathered speed. Burning buildings could be glimpsed out the ports. They passed a cluster of sprawled bodies beside a shattered wall. Darkness curtained the view by the time they rolled out onto the pier and stopped, but orange spots of fire could be seen on the surrounding hills. It was cold on the pier, and getting colder. Stephen found a flashlight and pointed it at Kate. There was a glassy look of fear in her eyes.
"Shut that off. Please, Stephen."
He turned off the torch and crawled under the blankets beside her. They could hear the cables being moved and adjusted against the chamber's metal. There was a grinding engine sound. Voices called out commands. Nillan Gunn's voice intruded from the speaker.
"Barrier Command's providing you with passage to England. They've sent in a barge and a tug. Not to worry. It's going to be all right. Now we're going to disconnect the compressor again to lift you off. It'll join you on the barge in only a few minutes. Bon voyage."
They heard the compressor go silent, more movements of the cables, more engine sounds. Metal rapped sharply against the side of the chamber, and a voice called out,
"Hold on in there. We're going to lift you now."
The chamber lurched, and they felt it swing. Stephen put an arm over Kate to steady her. The end port gave them a blurred view of bright spotlights and dark water, orange gouts of fire, then a swinging glimpse of dock buildings.
"Steady the thing, you idiots!" a voice shouted.
The swinging stopped. There came a sickening drop. Kate emitted a small shriek. The descent stopped, then resumed at a steadier pace, ending abruptly with a thump.
"Pass a line over both ends," someone shouted. "That's it. Then around here. Make it fast. Now the netting. There's going to be a lot of pitching about out there."
Kate wondered about that remark as they got underway. She heard the rumbling surge of powerful engines, then smooth movement detected mostly by watching the spotlights at the dockside recede. Stephen busied himself securing loose objects, tucking them in around the edges of the mattress, wedging them with books under the bed's plywood base, securing the safety lines. The smooth movement changed suddenly to a steady fore and aft tipping. Stephen leaned across her to peer out a port on her side. He could see only the dark side of the tug, an edge of a red running light. Within minutes the tipping became a lifting and dropping with definite pounding of water near the head of the chamber. Spray washed past the ports. Kate tasted a sourness in her throat. This new motion shifted suddenly to a heaving, pounding craziness, a twisting at the end of each drop. Stephen wedged himself against the side of their bed and held firmly to Kate. Only yesterday, Kate thought, she had been complaining because nothing changed in their quarters. The temperature had always been kept so annoyingly warm. She had used much of the morning to sort and fold their few items of clothing. A lucky thing. It had made the move into the little chamber much easier. She gripped Stephen's arm as the barge under them took that moment to make a particularly sickening descent into a wave. As they came up out of the trough, she felt something warm seep down both legs, then a gush of liquid.
"Stephen? It's all right, love. They'll get us across." "Stephen, the baby's coming," she wailed.
She tried to sit up, steadying herself with a hand against the wooden lip that Stephen had added to their bed, but the barge under them was dropping down into another trough, pitching her onto her back.
It was all wrong, she thought. Weren't there supposed to be pains first? Contractions? And it was too early. The baby wasn't due for more than a month.
Stephen groped for the torch, found it, and snapped it on. Kate had kicked off the blanket and lay now in a puddle of amniotic fluid. He left her for an instant to rip the sterilized sheet off its covering position over the lock. She helped him draw the sheet under her. It was still damp and smelled awfully of the antiseptic.
"Weren't there any contractions?" he asked. "Nothing but the water breaking. Something's wrong, Stephen."
Her voice degenerated into a wail.
"I'm afraid."
He wedged the torch beside the mattress, pointing it upward to reflect off the metal above them. His face appeared calm, but she knew he had only book knowledge of pregnancy and birth. She felt him taking command, though. He had the ropes rigged around his shoulders now, and another rope across her chest. The bed pitched and twisted terribly with the sea's movements. She heard the keening of the wind, the sodden slosh of water against the tank. The torch fell from its position. Stephen recovered it and wedged it more tightly.
"I can feel the contractions," she gasped. "Oh, not now."
"Be calm, darling.
Why couldn't it wait?"
Another contraction brought a cry from her.
"I don't know what to do," she wailed.
Perspiration ran off her body.
"I know what to do, darling. Let the contractions come." What was he doing down there?
She tried to lift her head and look down at him where he crouched between her legs. He pushed her back.
"Stay flat. Hold on to that rope." "It's too soon. It's too soon," she wailed.
She could feel the pitching of the barge as it drove Stephen lurching against her legs. Another contraction gripped her. Another.
"I'm timing them," Stephen said, a hand on her abdomen. "First, baby," she gasped. "It may be slow."
At least that was what the nursing manuals advised, she remembered. Another contraction. Another. She felt her world devolve into crazy motion and the periodic contractions.
"I can see the head," Stephen said. "That roll of dry blankets beside you on the left. I'll need one. See if you can reach it."
She was grateful for something to do. Between contractions, her clutching hand found the blankets and stripped one off. A pitching roll of the barge banged her head against the hard edge of the tank. She cried out but kept her grip on the blanket. Stephen did not look up. She felt his arms against the insides of her thighs. Another contraction set her moaning, but she remembered her training.
"Bear down with it."
She felt the baby slide out.
"The blanket!"
Stephen shouted. He jerked it from her hand. She saw him wrapping the baby in it.
"I've tied off the umbilicus," he said. "Is it alive?"
she gasped.
"It's a girl! And she's alive!"
There was joy in Stephen's voice.
"Is she all right? Her fingernails aren't complete, but she's got hair, and she's breathing. We have to keep her warm now. What about the afterbirth?"
"Everything's out."
"It was so quick."
"She's very small, darling." He loosened one of the ropes holding him and put the blanket-wrapped infant beside her.
"Hold her there with one hand while I move these ropes. We're pitching worse than ever. Can you still reach the blankets?"
"Yes."
Kate stared at a tiny face poking from the blanket beside her. It was an old face, so wrinkled. There was a little puddle of mucus at the nose. It bubbled as the baby breathed.
"It's too cold in here," Stephen said.
He passed a rope across Kate, moved the torch to a position nearer her head, and dragged more blankets across her. Presently he cinched the rope down tightly and lay beside her, holding to the rope. He made a tent of a blanket over their heads.
"We'll warm the air with our breathing, and our own bodies." "She's almost 2 months early, Stephen. She needs more than this blanket over her."
"I know." He extinguished the torch. "But it's all we have." Kate began to cry softly.
"What a terrible way to enter the world. What a terrible world."
"It's the only world she has, darling." The baby made a tiny hiccuping noise. Stephen flashed the torch on her face. The baby's lips were moving in and out. He sensed a hunger for life in the motion.
"Let me see her,"
Kate said. She raised herself on one elbow and stared down into her daughter's face.
"She hasn't been named,"
Kate said.
"We've not even thought about a name."
"There's no hurry."
"Stephen, if the cables break, this iron tank will sink like a stone."
"The cables aren't going to break. They've even put a net over us."
"We'll not have my daughter dying without a name."
He stared at Kate in the dim torchlight, feeling the wild motion of the sea, aware of the wind sounds, the waves shocking against the barge. Morbid thoughts were easy to have here, but they helped nothing.
"They've taken every precaution," he said. "It's a girl, Stephen. Don't you understand? It's a girl. The plague. Something awful is going to happen. I know it."
He could hear hysteria in her voice.
"Kate, you're going to be a nurse. You're my wife, and I've just delivered our first baby." "It's dirty in here," she said. "Sepsis."
"We'll not let you die of a fever, I say. Now stop this." He extinguished the torch.
"Dervagilla,"
Kate said. "What?"
"We'll call her Dervagilla," Kate said. "Gilla for short. Gilla Browder. It has a nice sound."
"Kate, have you a mind to the name you'd saddle this poor babe with?"
"You're thinking of the curse on the original Dervagilla."
"And on Diarmid, the man she ran off with."
"We're running off.
It's not the same."
"Dervagilla and Diarmid,"
Kate said.
"The two of them to wander Ireland and never find peace, never to be together until one Irishman forgives them."
"I'm not one to believe too much in luck," he said. "But that's a name to tempt fate." Kate's voice was firm.
"It's the curse of poor Ireland as well. Don't speak against it, Stephen. I know why this plague was laid upon us. Because we refuse to forgive Diarmid and Dervagilla."
"You heard that somewhere. The old men nattering back at the castle."
"Everyone says it."
"You're daft."
"You must forgive them, Stephen, and say you approve this name for our daughter."
"Kate."
"Say it."
Stephen cleared his throat. He felt on the defensive against this new Kate, this virago. He realized abruptly that she was a mother defending her child in the only way she knew. He felt a wash of tenderness for her and for their daughter.
"I forgive them, Kate. That's a pretty name. Thank you, Stephen. Now, our daughter will live."
He felt her moving the baby and turned the torch on her. She was trying to bring the baby to her breast.
I don't think she'll suckle yet, Kate. She's moving her mouth. It's when she breathes. Gilla, she said. A pretty name.
Stephen once more extinguished the torch. It was getting dim. They might need it. Kate closed her eyes. If this terrible motion would only stop. Darkness made it worse, and the wild noises outside. The sourness arose once more in her throat. Abruptly, with barely time for her to put her head out of the blanket shelter and turn away from the baby and Stephen, she vomited. The smell permeated the chamber.
"It's all right," she gasped, reaching for his hand to stop him from turning on the torch.
She did not want anyone seeing her like this.
"Take the baby."
She rested her cheek against the hard edge of wood beside the mattress, heaving and heaving. It was going into the books under the bed, she realized. The smell was awful. She heard Stephen taking deep breaths to keep himself from being sick. She tried to do the same, but her stomach was knotted too tightly. The nightmare went on and on, absorbing all of her energies. It was only gradually that she grew aware of a change in their motion. The barge was rocking only slightly now. Kate wiped her mouth on a corner of the blanket and thought she might live. There was a roaring of the tug's engines beside them, and they felt their motion reversing, then a crunch against pilings. The accents of British dock workers could be heard out there.
"Have a care, you bloody sod! Precious packet, this one! Get the lorry in closer!"
Once more the compressor went silent. They felt the chamber being lifted, steadier here. There came the expected thump as they were settled onto a lorry. Stephen found the microphone and keyed the switch.
"Hello out there."
There was no answer.
"Do you smell that?"
someone outside asked.
"Bloody puke," someone else said. "Look under the thing."
The compressor started up then. Someone pounded on the side of the tank.
"Hello in there. I think you've been breached. It's low down to the end here."
The hammering continued to locate it. Stephen grabbed up the torch and crawled out of the restricting rope toward the sound. The light was very dim, but he saw what he thought was a dark crack beneath the head of the bed. He looked around frantically for something to cover the place. Pressure was building in the chamber, and he heard a faint hissing, vomit being forced out of the crack. His books. He had packed some of them in a box wedged behind the toilet. Grabbing the first book off the top, he began tearing out pages and stuffing them over the crack.
"Get a welder over here," someone outside shouted.
Another voice called something that Stephen could not make out. Paper and vomit were making a crude patch, but as pressure built up in the chamber, he knew the patch would not hold.
"I don't care if you have to break his bloody door down," someone out there shouted. "Get that welder."
"We've been breached," Stephen thought. "The plague. It happened while the compressor was off."
He looked up and met Kate's staring eyes, shadowed holes in the reflected glare of a spotlight coming through the ports. She held Gilla in her arms.
"You've fixed it, haven't you, Stephen?"
she whispered.
"Yes, love. I knew you would."
"Faith," he thought. "It resists all reason."